Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the SOM TV podcast. My name is Jason Wise. On March 10th this year, a series of events were put in motion where a run on a bank called Silicon Valley Bank started, leaving this bank with a negative balance of $958 million. Now, why am I bringing this up on a wine podcast? Because it affected more wineries than you can possibly imagine. On today's podcast, I'm going to speak with Sarah Puhl, who is the founder of Boxed, a premium boxed wine company, to talk about the incredible effects that this small 24-hour period has and is going to have on the entire wine business in the United States. Before we get to that conversation, I want to remind all of you that SOM TV has over 500 hours of the absolute best educational and entertainment you can find in the culinary space. On March 28th, we have a brand new Behind the Glass documentary launching on the incredible story of Ross Knoll Vineyards. This is a 7-year project where we filmed an entire process of planting all the way till the third harvest of a vineyard. And it is really an incredible, long, long, long project. So I'm so excited to bring it to you. And Diane Carpenter, who founded it, is an immensely entertaining person. So you're going to love that on March 28th. Go to somtv.com and make sure to subscribe. Tell your friends, your dog, and your parents. Really helps us out. Without further ado, my conversation about how the current financial crisis affects the wine business. So Sarah, it's great to have you on the SOM TV podcast. I wish that it was under better circumstances, I guess, considering you have every right to be here for 1,000 other reasons. But right now we're going to talk about something that has been paramount in the news, which is the current financial, would you call it a collapse? How do we start this?
Debacle? I think debacle.
A good debacle.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot has been said about the tech industry and the overall financial issue going on with the banking system in the United States. I don't know that a lot of people understand how much this affects the wine industry. And you were kind of an interesting one to bring on because you overlap in a weird way sort of with tech and, you know, innovation and wine. I just want to ask you from 20,000 feet, what happened?
Yeah, I mean, what happened from, 20,000 feet is the bank collapsed. That's a big thing. And how does a bank collapse? I guess there's probably a lot of reasons, all of which I'm not educated on. But in this particular case, the bank had a lot of bonds, the feds raised interest rates, and, they lost a lot of money. And then, they made an announcement, and venture capital, which is the partner of Silicon Valley Bank, and obviously innovation in this country, said, hey, entrepreneurs, take your money out. And that run on the bank ultimately led to its collapse in less than 48 hours from their announcements on Wednesday. I mean, it is a stunning, fast, quick picture into, the capitalization of banks, actually. So it's an education that I'm getting on the fly.
Yeah, well, as if selling wine and the way you sell wine wasn't hard enough.
Yeah.
Now you have to get on podcasts like mine and speak to the financial crisis, which is interesting, which leads me to my next question. And we'll get to what you do, and which is fantastic. But why does this have anything to do with wine? Why does Silicon Valley Bank's collapse have anything to do with wine? Why are you on a wine podcast?
Yeah, totally. It's interesting. I think a lot of people, and this was one of my things as this was all unfolding in the early days, I think intellectually people think Silicon Valley Bank, venture capital, tech bros, the whole, some healthcare tech, ed tech, any kind of tech. But they're not thinking about consumer and wine. And Silicon Valley Bank has a very big wine practice. I think it's 2% of the bank's work is actually in the wine industry. So as this was all unfolding in, Napa, there was lots of different social activities happening. And this was the topic because Silicon Valley Bank is a big partner to the wine industry. So that's why. I mean, they were a big partner in debt and obviously in banking for my friends in the wine industry.
So last weekend I was up in Napa. This was like the right when this happened. So I had a screening up there, and I would say that there was an air of I'm trying to think if it was like the air of like somebody died or a funeral across the entire valley in Napa.
Yeah.
And it was a wild situation because I was texted that this happened, I believe, very early in the morning, I think was when it started happening.
Yep.
And it started falling like dominoes. And I didn't realize how many people Silicon Valley touched. We'll just take Napa as a petri dish, because I'm sure it's across Sonoma and anywhere else. Why did a bank like this end up in the wine sector? Because I've heard I've heard stats that this is a huge percentage of organizations, businesses, individuals that this touched. I won't name names, but many people that are very important to SOMTV, our films, are or have been panicking a lot.
Listen, I don't know exactly how Silicon Valley Bank became like the wine bank, but I would, and I feel like I've heard this in my conversations with my bankers. I mean, part of it is you have entrepreneurs who had debt facilities and all sorts of things and did banking and mortgage. I mean, Silicon Valley Bank did a lot for entrepreneurs. And then you have a successful startup, and what do people want to do? They want to skip through the vineyards and make wine. And, you know, the bank was there to support.
I'm just picturing all these tech bros, know, right? Arm in arm, just skipping through the vines.
I know, but look, Gavin image. Newsom banked with the bank, right? His winery Odette. And I think he has three wineries now. And that's the thing. So they became a big partner. Also, I'm sure, you know, they produced the state of the industry report every year that was so thorough and gave you a deep understanding of what people's preferences were, how they were buying it. I mean, one of the major outlets for research for me is I was contemplating starting Boxed and understanding what the industry looked like and where the opportunities were. So yeah, I mean, I think a big piece of it is as you're sitting in the middle of Silicon Valley and they're in the middle of wine country, it made a lot of sense for the bank to get involved in people who wanted to be entrepreneurs or business leaders in the wine space.
All right. So why don't we go right into what it is that you do and how you found yourself. Now, we should say a couple things. Over $250,000, because the FDIC, what, they insure?
Yep, up to $250,000.
$250,000?
Yep.
And so anything above that, there's the risk on a collapse that you just flat out, and correct me if I'm wrong, you just lose that money potentially.
Yeah.
You could lose it.
Yeah. I think that's the part that, you know, Thursday and Friday and over the weekend, that first weekend, you're thinking to yourself, what does this look like? What does it mean? And I was reading an article, and it's just true. And this is true, whether it's a bank collapse or not a bank collapse. When you're an entrepreneur that's at an early stage like mine, or you're not quite, you know, profitable yet, you only have so much cash until, you know, you fundraise again. And however you end up getting to zero, if you're at zero, it's game over, right? So if it goes to zero tomorrow because a bank's collapsed and you have no access to the capital, it does me no good if in a year somebody comes back and says, oh, here's your money, because business is gone.
We all know that your company Boxed is worth $127 million.
Billion dollars.
And you billion dollars.
So I could have single-handedly saved the bank myself, but I decided let's let the feds do it.
Yeah, that's very, very noble of you. So what is it that you and your team did here? Let's get this out, because I think what you did is pretty impressive, and obviously you're at the early stages, but what is Boxed?
So what is Boxed?
What did you create?
Yeah, so I, first of all, I did not set out to be an entrepreneur just in life in general. That was not I didn't think that was like my life's mission. But I met a VC out of Austin, Texas, and he invited me to be an entrepreneur in residence at his firm. And what that means is, hey, let's take some time. Let's give you a little time, tinker on some ideas you had, which actually was in podcasting, which is very interesting that we're on a podcast right now. And
run from that.
Well, I obviously did. I went in the total different direction. Although what I could have done is wine and podcasting, and I could have been like you. And so during my time ideating, I was challenged to think about where do my interests, my aptitude, and my experience intersect. And Box was born, which I know sounds a little bit crazy. So my experience in wine is consuming it. And when you start thinking about the wine industry, first of all, I'm a massive fan of the wine industry. My company is not here to stick up my middle finger at the way the wine industry works. It's here to be a part of the ecosystem, because I believe there's room for all of us. And what Boxed is we're on a mission to be your house wine. I want to be what you drink on Tuesday when you get home and you're just like, I need a glass of wine and I want to know I'm going to like it. And I'm too old to drink shitty wine that when I open the bottle, I'm like, what did I open here? So Boxed is a kind of a simplification of house wine, that beautiful European table wine that you're used to when you sit in a cafe in Paris and you're like, hey, just I'll have a carafe of the red. And you don't ask questions. Sometimes here in the States, we ask so many questions that by the time you get the glass, it's inevitable that you're not going to love it because you've overanalyzed, or you're staring down the bottles at the supermarket or your wine store. And you're like, I think I want to spend, it's Tuesday, I guess I want to spend $25. And then you're like, all right, here's my $25 range. And then what do? You kind of pick by variety and you kind of pick by label, and then you cross your fingers and go for it. I just didn't want to do that anymore. So we are putting ultra premium wine on tap. And that's not just by what I mean, that's what I said to begin with, but we've won 33 medals in the past year and a half, including double gold at the San Francisco International Wine Competition. So we are not shipping shit. We're shipping really great wine with no additives, 0 grams of sugar per serving. Like, we are just putting really great, beautiful wines in our box. So 8 wines, 3 whites, a rosé, and 4 reds. And it's very simple. What we do is we source wine from all over the world and blend to our taste profiles at our own fully licensed bonded winery, put them in the box, and ship them to your door.
So when you created this, what was, and we'll get to kind of why you needed to, you know, what your affiliation was with the banking system and everything. What did you have to do? What were the core, what were the hard costs here that you needed to raise money for?
I mean, listen, one, you had to have inventory, right? So if somebody places an order, you can't then go figure out what to do and how to put the wine together. But one, licensing was a very big upfront expense. In order to have permission to ship directly to a door and cut out the distribution channel, if you will, we needed to be a winery, a fully licensed bonded winery. And then we needed to go state by state and apply for licenses for permission to ship directly to somebody's door. So that is a really hard cost. There's lots of legal, lots of understanding it. And once you do that, you still have to do monthly reports. And sometimes it's every state's so different in terms of when they want reporting, so they know exactly what you've sent into their state. So there's ongoing kind of massive legal side of it that just continues on, you know, till the end of time. Then there's all the inventory stuff. There's all the e-commerce and how are you setting it up? There's the branding work that you have to do. So it's not a small feat to get to the place where you are a fully licensed bonded winery, you know, ready to ship and with product to ship.
So when you approach this bank, you I'm trying to figure out which angle to hit this from, because for you, you know, you took money people invested and put it in Silicon Valley Bank. Is that how it worked for you?
Yeah. So essentially what I did is, you know, and everybody who's starting a business might do it a little differently. We raised venture capital kind of through that, being an entrepreneur in residence at a VC firm. The whole idea of that was for me to come up with an idea that ultimately they wanted to fund, and they did. And so when you raise venture, you know, the money has to go somewhere. So it went into Silicon Valley Bank, which, you know, was a recommendation by the firm that was our lead investor, and a recommendation that frankly was a great one. I mean, I really do have a lot of nice things to say about the team at Silicon Valley Bank here in Austin. They aren't just my bankers. They're my friends. They know my business. They buy my wine. They check in with me. We're constantly talking. I have an account at Bank of America and Chase, and, you know, I just started a relationship with my Chase banker like 4 months ago, and it's because we moved my mortgage to him. But other than that, like, you know, you can't get, it's so hard for a small business that has no track record, no revenue. And, you know, it took me, you know, a year to get licensed. So there was no revenue and I'm needing to invest in the business to actually take you seriously. And that's why Silicon Valley Bank was so important, because they offered venture debt that ran alongside of venture capital that I raised, because they trusted that the VC was making a smart investment in this concept.
All right. So the morning happens. How do you find out what happened, and what did you find out happened? Because I think a lot of people have heard about this from a financial, completely financial aspect, you know, a Planet Money, here's what's happening with the overall market. But I think it's interesting because you touch sort of all three of the, you touch banking, you touch wine, and in a weird way, you touch tech, which is kind of a very bizarre place for you to be. I'm sure you're ecstatic to be in all three of those places right now. So how did you find out?
I was actually out to dinner on Wednesday night with my bankers and three other entrepreneurs. We were just having drinks and dinner and just like catching up on all the things and like what's hard, what's not hard. We weren't, and the news was actually starting to break on Wednesday night. But because we were kind of in this pod of entrepreneurs and taking time to do that, which is fairly rare, none of us were looking at our phones and none of us were looking, you know, reading the news. We're like sitting at dinner, just, you know, catching up on figuring out who needs help with what. So, you know, I get home, I go to bed, didn't read the news, wake up, take my five-year-old to school. And I'm actually wearing my Silicon Valley Bank hat at drop-off. An entrepreneur that I talk to almost every day in the parking lot was like, hey, look at you, solidarity with the bank, love it. And I was like, what are you talking about? And jump in the car and just like pull up. And I'm like, wait a second, what is happening here? And so that's exactly how I found out, sitting in the parking lot of my kids' school here in Austin, wearing my Silicon Valley Bank hat, not realizing that I'm making a statement as I'm walking through the school that my kid goes to, because there's a lot of entrepreneurs at the school. And so, you know, that's when you start to read and say, hey, what's really happening here? And then you get, you know, I got on some of my Slack channels with other entrepreneurs that I've been connected with over the years and like little groups that we've formed. And you kind of got the range of like, oh, it's nothing to, it's something to, and then the day just rolled on, you know, and then all of a sudden you've got big VCs saying, we're telling our people to pull their money. And I'm actually sitting on the tarmac at Austin and about to take off. And that's when I saw Peter Thiel was like, I'm telling everybody to pull their money out of the bank. And that's when you're like sitting there.
For reference, Peter Thiel is an angel investor in Facebook, really famous.
PayPal guy. One of the really big PayPal guys.
PayPal guy.
Yeah.
Tech bro, would you say?
haven't we come up with a word yet?
No, I don't know that we have. But Peter Thiel sits there in his like Hugh Hefner robe of tech bros, I would say. Anyway, so Peter Thiel.
So yeah, he says that. And that's when you start to say, as an entrepreneur, I think that's the thing in these early stage pieces of the company. Like I said, when you're not quite at profitability yet, you're forced with saying, what is everything I can read right now? Who can I talk to? Who can I ask? Because I feel like I have big choices to make. You start trying to make them.
Well, it's a weird thing to think how helpless you are, but it's still, not that this helps you feel any better, but it's not your fault. I mean, it's not like anything you did would have led
to this not happening.
So the question I have for you is, did you react? Did you take your money out? Did you panic? What was your initial response? And how did that play out?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, I've given up on panicking. It serves me no purpose. So I'm not a big panicker. I'm like more of a get in the shower, cry for 10 seconds, get over it and keep moving kind of gal. That's, you know, you're like,
that's good.
And then you just like, what's the next thing you're going to hit me with, entrepreneur land? And so I didn't. I was able to move some of our money, not all of it. The big thing for me that I was worried about is in the picture of when you think about your runway as a not quite profitable business is your access to debt. And that was the big thing, is like, even if, as the FDIC said, they would make you whole in your cash, the debt's a whole other thing. And the other thing that you start to think about is, what does this do to the fundraising landscape? It was already an incredible over the last two quarters, difficult fundraising landscape, and it was only getting more difficult. And this just blew up fundraising. And so I'm not in a fundraise right now, but the real question for us, and that's what we're dealing with right now, is what does this look like? How are we looking at the cash we have, the debt facility we have that we're trying to make sure is secure, and say, what adjustments do we have to make? So that's, you know, it opens up this massive can of worms as somebody who's, you know, building a business.
Now, the government came in and said they're going to, I guess, bail out. I don't know. It's
make your deposits whole. Yeah, they're saying like make your deposits whole. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I was reading some of the stuff this week, and it's like, you know, Janet Yellen is like, the taxpayers won't pay. Yeah, but at the end of the day, somebody pays for it. So let's be honest. Bank fees are, I mean, somehow your bank fees are going up. Something's going up. Your tax, something's going up. And we will all pay for this. Everybody will pay for this.
So when that money, has it become available? The money that you had in the bank, is it now able to take out, or how is this shaken up?
We're working on it. The access in and out has been rough, and we're working on it.
Do you guys have enough liquidity to stay alive currently?
Yes. Yes.
And I mean, yeah, I mean, you must, because you have all your hair still, yeah, which is good.
I do have all my hair. And you know what? I think like that's, I mean, it's part of the ride, right? And one thing I'll say about our team. Yeah, it's a wig. Wouldn't it be funny if I just like took my hair off right now and you were like, oh shit.
I mean, good. I would do the same thing. It would look awesome.
Oh, that would be awesome. What's that movie reference where they all have no hair with Dan Aykroyd?
Oh, something's got to give, or Nothing But Trouble.
Nothing But Trouble. Yeah.
Oh my God. Did you just pull a Nothing But Trouble reference out of here? Yeah. There's like no one seen that movie on this except you and I. I love that, with the bone roller coaster.
Yeah, exactly.
That's kind of what it feels like, just like going through this process.
That is what being an entrepreneur feels like, for sure.
Oh, trust me. I can tell you, I started a streaming service with three other people. I can tell you right now, I would recommend everybody just go get your CPA or go into HVAC, heating and cooling. Do not do this.
Yeah, be
this
like is not, a brain surgeon.
It's not for the faint of heart. Yeah, or a brain surgeon. I'm thinking whatever. Air conditioning, but that's fine.
Plumber.
A plumber, anything where there's job security.
Yeah.
Okay, so when you are able to get your money out, are you going to put it into a more traditional bank? Are you going to keep it with this bank?
Listen, going to diversify the hell out of that money because you just have to. You know, if I'm being really honest, SVB, the Bridge Bank, Silicon Valley Bridge Bank, and I love my local bankers, just so we're super clear, they're awesome. This is not them, but the mothership, the new CEO, it's like all of a sudden we're kind of acting like nothing happened. And the communication you get is kind of like, we're open for business and everything's great. Yay. We got an email last night from them being like, everybody needs to put their money back because we're open for business and we're trying to work some deals so we can sell the bank. And you're like, you're not helping me make me feel better about this. So it's a very weird vortex of like, nothing to see here, people. And it's stunning, to be honest. But yes, I'm going to put my money in multiple places.
It's such an interesting thing because this is still playing out as we talk.
Yeah.
And I think at some point I want to get you back on to say kind of what happened, and then you can remove your hair. It'll be great.
Yeah.
But for the moment, you know, business for you operates, right?
Business operates. I mean,
wine.
Yeah, thankfully we're shipping out wine. We're telling our story. And I think that's one of the, you know, what silver lining, maybe it's giving us a voice, and that's helpful so that people can hear about, you know, the range of innovation that's happening in this country and how people can participate in powering, you know, the economy. Because the reality is, you know, every business starts out tiny. They don't pop overnight, and small business powers our economy. And so to the extent that people can look at this and say, hey, what are the small businesses that I love that I can be a part of? And it's really easy. You can do two things. You can buy our wine, or you can, or somebody else's, or you can refer somebody to us. Or if you see a company that's doing something really neat and social or whatever it is, and maybe it's not for you, but you have a friend that you're like, oh, I need to tell them about this. You know, tell them. You should tell them instead of just liking a post.
Yeah, that's right. Liking a post does not do much. As far as my experience with the wine industry is, if they are rich, it's because they were before wine, generally. Yeah. And I don't mean to say that wine can't be profitable.
So what you're saying is I'm the asshole that came in to try to do it backwards.
So listen, I told you, I started a streaming service. You're in a better place. So what I can say though is that money, people who work in the wine business and really started from ground zero. I don't mean they started with, you know, a bunch of Ford dealerships and then made a winery.
Yep.
I'm talking about they made a winery and built up. If you have $100,000, that's like $2 million to you. You know, I mean, every single penny is a much more valuable thing in the way you have to work.
Yeah.
So when I was up in Napa, and again, I won't name names on this, but I have a very strong feeling on a follow-up podcast, people have some very harsh and strong opinions about how this all went down. But I haven't seen this directly syringe into the wine business like this before, because I promise you it's somewhere near, like they say, 38-39% of the major wineries up in Napa and Sonoma
and connection other places with SVB
are directly affected. And I mean, like, they had all their eggs in this basket.
Yep. Yeah.
And so it was sort of this element of Napa itself or the wine industry itself could fall down on itself because of this. And that I have never seen. I've never seen something like that.
Well, it goes back to your point. You asked me why Silicon Valley Bank's invested in wine. Well, you said it. Most people don't start a winery unless they already had money to start it with. And Silicon Valley Bank is the bank of innovation in this country and, you know, powered entrepreneurs. And oftentimes entrepreneurs worked with Silicon Valley Bank. And Silicon Valley Bank, you know, is giving mortgages to people kind of before they made money, like all sorts of things, right? And so if you're already there and they're already your bankers and they're creating these deep personal relationships with you, of course, when you make your money and then you say, hey, I want to do this, I want to start this new business, SVB's like, I've been supporting you now for years. Let's do this. I'm on board. And so it made sense for them to have a wine practice.
Yeah, it does. It does. And it's really a shame that there is not a secondary option, I think, right now for wineries, for people trying to do startups within the wine and the food business. These are tricky waters, and we'll continue to cover this. But before we leave this, I do want to talk about what you make a little bit more. So how hard was it to convince people, and I'm sure it's an ongoing process, to convince people that premium wine can exist in the form of a box? Because I think for me, you know, I grew up in the Midwest, and I've talked a lot on this podcast that my entry point was Franzia.
Oh, yes.
You know, on the Easter brunch table, and it came in a box. And so how do you overcome people's stigma with putting wine in a box?
You know, there's a lot of elements to it. And now that we are, you know, 2.5 years into shipping wine, the good news is the hypothesis that you could pour a glass out of this 4-bottle format and it tastes really good. I've proven that. Now it's just about getting more people to see it and touch it and taste it, right? Liquid to lips is mm-hmm. what I like to say. And we talk about on our team. So like that's one thing. It's like, you have to have really good wine and you can't have people being like, I'm getting hangovers, et cetera. Really good wine. Really, you don't get sick unless you drink too much. Let's be honest. I mean, that's kind of with all alcohol, like the better the alcohol you're drinking, the less sick you get unless you drink too much. So that's one thing we had.
From my experience, you can drink through that though.
Yes.
If you keep going.
Yeah. If you keep going, then you can just get sick. And then the other thing is like visually, I had to change the dynamic and that's where the wooden box came in. And so we put it in a wooden box. So because we decided to go directly to the consumer, if we had gone into retail, right, we would have been designing to fight for your attention of your eyeball, which meant we were fighting for shelf space. The way I thought about it was, I don't want you to be embarrassed about my box and I want it to be out on your counter. So I wanted permission for the reds, at least, to be on your counter. And I wanted permission for the whites to be in your fridge in your kitchen, not your fridge in your garage with all your other beverages that you're hiding that you don't want people to see that you have. And so, you know, when you see our box on the countertop, you don't think about boxed wine. It's literally not the first thing that comes to your head. The first thing that comes to your head in most people's cases is like, what is that over there? And inevitably people knock on it. And I'm like, yeah, it's wood. Inevitably, when people get it for the first time, they knock on it. People love to knock on the box. It's actually kind of funny. And then they taste it. And then they're like, oh shit, this is good. And then they tell somebody. And so I love when I get somebody who is, a self-proclaimed wine expert. We have one guy here in town. I love it. There was a golf tournament here in town and it was like a Ryder Cup style thing in a country club. And I went to one of the groups Monday night kickoff pizza and wine evening. And they're like, well, when this guy comes, if he likes it, then it's good, blah, 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 blah. Well, this gentleman, I won't say his name just in case he ends up listening to this because he'll know. This gentleman who has the same name as my daughter has bought quite a bit of our wine and continues to buy it and buys multiple. And he's, you know, on a first name basis with our head of our concierge team. And he's like, this is great house wine. And that's it. I don't want to be every single bottle. That's not what I'm asking you to do. I'm just saying drinking from a box is just a smarter way to drink wine at home. And there's a great, when people taste it and they're like, oh, it's a great value. That's what people want. That value equation, plus it's just smarter. And so it's just like one person at a time. And then, you know, things like this, like people are like, wait a second, you're going to pay attention to this box wine, and then you keep going from there.
Yeah, no, it's great. What do you offer wine wise? I'm just curious as a drinker with children.
Yeah, how old are your kids?
Needs
by
to
the
drink
way,
because I have a 6 and a 10 year old.
Oh, 6 and 10. So I have a 5 year old. Yeah,
both little girls.
Oh yeah, my daughter. Yep, 5 year old daughter. I just have one. I can only do one. That was good enough for me. But I have 8 wine babies, and we name our wines by number. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And then we have number 9 and then 4, 5. So real quick, 1, 2, and 3. 1 is a really light, bright, crisp, you know, most people would be like, oh, a Savvy B style. 2 has, you know, a little bit of that oak butterscotch vibe. I like to call it Rombauer Light. For those that
Rombauer Light.
Yeah. For those that need a little butter in their glass. And then number 3 is our white that has just like a little bit of palatable sweetness. And we don't lead with variety intentionally because our 5 senses work together. And, you know, I think one of the things that used to annoy me about, I just moved to Texas a couple of years ago from San Francisco. I lived in the city for 22 years. And so spent a lot of time up in Napa and Sonoma. And, you know, you'd go wine tasting and everybody be around and they're like pouring and somebody's like, oh, I can smell asphalt. Oh, it's so good. I'm like, asphalt doesn't taste good. I wouldn't know because I haven't tasted it. But it was like consensus tasting, which I find to be annoying. I'm like it or don't like it. Like, you should like what's in your glass. And when you lead with Chardonnay is such a great example, because you and I both know that Chardonnay does not have to taste like butter or oak or whatever you want to call it. You know what I mean? But oftentimes here in the United States of America, it does, or that's what the perception of it. And so people will come to tasting and be like, oh, I hate Chardonnay, blah, blah, blah. And then they taste our number 2 and they're like, oh my God, I'm a diehard number 2. And if you lead with variety, you start telling people things that they think they know about what it's going to taste like versus just tasting it. And so it's not that we don't talk about it. It's that we say, hey, let's just taste through the numbers. Let's find your match. And then let's unpack the bag. And so then you can start to find other things you might like that are in bottle format for whatever the bottle occasions happen to be, because there's plenty. I drink a pie chart of wine.
And then the reds, I mean, obviously this is interesting because you're catering to what is an overall spectrum of what people like to drink?
Yeah, so,
and then trying to sort of narrow that down. That's an interesting way to go about this, honestly.
Yeah. People are like, are you going to have more wines? And I'm like, nope. What we might do is we might go up a level. So they might be like, instead of number 1, it might be 0-1. And that could be like a super black label and the price doubles, you know, and we just get a little weird on it. And so, yeah, that's exactly right. It's like a spectrum of wine. And then it's like, you know, it's like your pH balance or whatever, you know, the pool little stick of what's going on in your pool.
Do you see a world where like there could be, you know, a Premier Cru Burgundy in a box? I mean, there could be a $160 box of wine.
For sure. For sure, because the reality is it stays fresh for up to 6 weeks. So, you know, we can cater to taste buds. You know, I think of myself not as a winery or a wine company, even though I'm both of those things. I think of myself as a taste bud company. And so what does that mean? It means, hey, Jason, you're a diehard number 4. Like, that's your go-to Tuesday, Wednesday wine. And then I find out that it's, you know, your daughter's birthday. And we send you a little email and we're like, hey, Jason, how about this beautiful bottle of wine to celebrate the birth of your child? And you're like, yeah, I trust you. I know you're going to like that. And so you think about like, where can you go? I mean, we're focused right now on being your house wine for, you know, those Monday through Friday occasions, sometimes Saturday and Sunday too. But I think that there's
sometimes Tuesday, yeah,
all the days, but you know, there's kind of this expansion of where you can go when you focus on taste buds and what the taste bud wants.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I think too, when people sort of shit on different enclosures of wine, I always find it funny because, you know, if you are in Paris and you're drinking the red, which is probably a simple Beaujolais,
yeah,
it's poured out of a cask.
Totally.
In the bar.
Totally,
so
right,
it's like
in the bar.
Poured out of a cask. I mean, they bring you a bottle and set it down, but guess what? They filled that bottle up from the cask. And so, and that cask has been reused and, you know, sat empty for a while, then got refilled. It's not like there's it's not a reverence to the container like it is in the United States, where you have a 400-pound glass bottle to signify it's an expensive wine. It's a very different thing in Europe. And I think that's a really fascinating way to approach this. I really do.
Yeah. I mean, listen, right now it's about speed, right? Because you need to move fast enough that you can be capital efficient and grow fast enough so that we can, you know, live forever. But yeah, like it was always my thing. You never ask when you're sitting, like I said, at a cafe in Paris, like, what's your house wine? You're like, just give me a carafe of the house wine. And they're like, do you want the large or small? And I'm like, I want the double large. All right. Like, let's roll. And then you might ask like, hey, where did this wine come from? But other than that, like you're just like, it tastes good. You're like, this tastes good.
Yeah. The only disadvantage you have is we're not in Paris.
Well, I think we should just all pretend.
We're in Paris.
Get That's a right. baguette and pretend.
Well, this is great. Sarah, this is great. Tell everybody where they can get your wine.
You can head to drinkboxt with a T, not a D, a T, drinkbox.com. And if you use the code SAVESMALL, you'll get a little discount on your first order.
That's great. That is fantastic. And I hope everything sort of calms down a little bit for you. I know that this is hard enough having a business and running the logistics and all of that without having to worry about whether or not the money's available to do it. So
listen, we will press on. We're fired up. Like, this is not the way we go down. In fact, we don't go down at all. And some bank blowing up is like nothing. Like, fine, let's roll.
You're like, I'll make this wine in the middle of a war. I don't even care.
I mean, that's exactly right. Yeah, I'm in a banking war right now, and I accept.
Well, Sarah, I look forward to having you on to get an update on what the hell happened. And for everybody following the financial situation, there's plenty out there to see. I will say it's changing almost like hourly on how things are shaking out. So, you know, from the wine perspective, it's an honor to have you on. Thank you, Sarah. I want to thank everybody for listening. We're going to have Sarah back on because this is something that is going to be playing out over the next weeks and months. It's really, really, really going to have a tremendous impact on the wine business. I'm mentioning the tech sector as well. Make sure if you love this podcast, please give us a great review wherever you listen. It is incredibly important to us. And I know you're out there listening. So take 2 seconds to just give us a good review. Go to somtv.com for all the great content we have and what we have coming. Don't forget the 28th of March, we have our brand new Behind the Glass episode on Ross Noel Vineyard. You do not want to miss this. All right, everybody, be safe and stuff your money in your mattress next to your wine bottles. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.